Okay, thank you so much everybody for coming. As I indicated in the email that I sent out to members of the class, we're going to be taking a break from our regularly scheduled Judaism and Christianity programming, and instead we're going to focus this time on the Haggadah. It's an issue that I've dealt with in the Jewish Center before, but my thinking on this topic has developed, and so I hope you'll indulge me with reviewing some of the items that we've covered before. It's a really, I think, fascinating topic that stands at the very epicenter of the Haggadah, and as such, I think requires our direct attention in terms of elucidating a very difficult, challenging, and at the same time uplifting passage in the very middle of the Haggadah. So now, at the center of the Haggadah in a larger sense, in other words, if I were to ask, what's the most crucial moment, or extended moment in the Haggadah, or rather in the Seder evening, what might we say? So of course, Kiddush opens up everything, Hallel, broadly speaking, closes everything. What stands at the very middle, aside from the meal?
Magid,
right. Well, right, the kids, right. In terms, in a pedagogical sense, I think those answers are actually identical. Magid, the purpose of the Magid is to answer the questions that are being posited, or at the very least to make sure that the Masorah of the Exodus and the traditions associated with it are passed down from generation to generation in the tradition of Tanakh. Now, within the Maggid itself, what stands at the center of the Maggid? So now if I were to throw this question out, we might get a variety of answers. I'm curious to hear what people think.
That God took, you say, that you brought the Maggid in Egypt?
Right, so now that's an excellent point. In other words, the structure of Maggid is one that proceeds, in the words of the Mishnah, from genus to shevach. It proceeds from degradation to exaltation. So if we're going to pinpoint one moment in the Maggid that might be central to that, so what would it be? I imagine people would have very different answers. Some people might say the Manishtana is the crucial moment in the Maggid. Others might say the answer to the Manishtana, the Avadim Hayinu, or whatever it might be the crucial moment. Maybe perhaps both of those together. In fact, Pesach, Matzah, and Mar, Rabbi Gamliel, yes, of course, that's another option.
But we have another generation.
Yes,
that it's not just a historical story.
Right, Ela Shebachol Dor Vador.
It's a living right.
Absolutely, right, that might be another one. Right, so Mr. Comet, of course, is very perceptive, and he's noted that I've given you a text here in the very first source, and this is going to be the text that I've identified. So, in fact, halachically speaking, the most important part of the Maggid, which we have to be Doresh Ad Sofa, which we have to explicate from beginning to end, is the series of psukim from Sefer Devarim that we recite, or that Jews recite in the times of the Beis HaMikdash, when they bring Bikurim, the Mikra Bikurim. Yes, Arami Aved Avi, and so on and so forth. Father is a wandering Aramean, and so on and so forth. That's the portion that is crucial to the Maggid. It stands structurally and categorically, it stands at the very center of the Maggid. And in fact, it is there that we find, I think, one of the most difficult to interpret passages in the entire Haggadah. And what I'd like to do is explore it. Now, our exploration is going to be grounded, and I think, in a little-known historical fact, at least popularly speaking, which is that our Haggadah is, in fact, one version of one recension of the Haggadah. Broadly speaking, ours is the sort of Ashkenazic version of the Haggadah. Broadly speaking, there are two recensions of the Haggadah. They don't break down along Ashkenazic Sephardic lines, surprisingly. Perhaps not surprisingly. They break down along other geographical lines. Now, what might that be? Does anybody know? There is the... Yes, exactly, Solonoff. There is the Eretz Yisrael version of the Haggadah, and there is the Babylonian version of the Haggadah. We can identify, and there's lots of manuscript evidence, whether from the Kairo Geniza, whether from the text of the Rambam's Mishneh Torah at the end of Hilchos Chametz Matzah, whether from Rav Sadja Gaon Seder, from Rav Amram Gaon Seder. We have all sorts of evidence that allows us to establish that there were basically two versions of the Haggadah, the Eretz Yisrael version and the Babylonian version. They're distinct, first of all, in terms of the basic halachic differences between Eretz Yisrael and Bavel, which is to say that Bavel has a more systematized and in some cases just flat out different form of brachos, form of benching. It has Dayenu, it has Baruch HaMakom, it has things of that sort. It has different versions of the question of the Manishtana. It has four clauses, usually instead of three. The Eretz Yisrael version has a more fluid form of brachos that correspond in some cases to piyutim, to the work of the paitanim, the liturgical poets of Eretz Yisrael. Most importantly, it has in some cases, just a different form of magid, which is to say a less elaborated form of magid. And at the very center, and this was in fact a major bone of contention between the Babylonian Gaonim and the denizens of Eretz Yisrael, the central portion of the Magid that I've identified, the point where we explicate the psukim of Devarim that refer to Bikurim, this was one major difference between how things were done in Eretz Yisrael and communities influenced by Eretz Yisrael and how things were done in Babel. In Eretz Yisrael, rather, in Babel, and our tradition reflects this, and this was a major halachic sticking point for the Gaonim, the Mikra Bikurim Midrash had to be elaborated ad nauseum. The words of the Mishnah were taken quite literally, which is that every single word of the Mikra Bikurim Midrash had to be given a drasha. So if you'll notice, when you go this year, when you go through the Haggadah, when we go through those psukim in Devarim, from Arami Ovid Avi until Vayotzeinu Hashem Misham, every single word kimat gets a drasha. In Eretz Yisrael, by contrast, there was very little drash. There is really a paucity of midrashic material that is appended to those psukim. The only ones that you find in the earliest form of the Eretz Yisrael version that we have is Anos al Pi Adibor, the one that refers to Loya de Malach, Loya de Shaliach, and so on and so forth, and then one that we're going to look at in just a moment. In the Babylonian form of the Haggadah, you get this big elaboration, especially of the Mikra Bikurim Midrash. Now, that's all by way of background. The very last pasuk of the portion of Psukim and Dvarim that we say when we bring the Bikurim, the very last pasuk has a unique feature that appears only once in the entire Babylonian form of the Haggadah, and doesn't appear at all in the Eretz Yisrael Haggadah, and that is, we are made privy to, in fact, two drashas on a single pasuk. It's the only time in the Haggadah where the words davar acher, in other words, Chazal used the words davar acher to indicate that here is one midrash, and then davar acher, another matter, here is a second midrash. It's the only time in the Haggadah where we're given two midrashim to one pasuk. What I'd like to do is quickly before we, and then what I'd like to do first of all, first and foremost, is to read through the drasha, translate it. And then, as I'm translating, as we're reading together, keep in mind what exactly it is that the text says, and try to identify, if we can, peculiarities or perhaps outright contradictions that you might notice, anything that strikes you as odd, because there are lots of odd things about this passage. So let's quickly read. The text that I'm going to give you is, with the exception of the very last paragraph, and I'll let you know when we arrive at it, every bit of this appears only in the Haggadahs that are of the Babylonian Rite, that appear in Gullus, in the diaspora. The very last paragraph that begins with Davar Acher, that Midrash and that Midrash alone appears in the Eretz Yisrael Haggadah. So we're going to have to explore why that's relevant, why that might be significant, but let's read through this together. B'yad Chazaka, the Pasuk says that God took the Jewish people out of Egypt with a mighty hand. Zo hadever, k'mashin emar, hine yad Hashem hoya b'miknecha, asher basadeh, basusim, b'chamorim, b'gemalim, b'bakar, v'atzon, dever kaved ma'od. By mighty hand, this refers to the pestilence, the dever. As it is said, then the hand of the Lord will strike your livestock in the fields, the horses, the donkeys, the camels, the cattle, and the sheep, with a very severe pestilence. The next word. Uvizroa nituya, zo hacherev. By an outstretched arm, this refers to the sword. As it is said in Divrei Hayamim, with a drawn sword in his hand, directed against Jerusalem. Then, uvmora gadol, an awesome power, zo giloi shchina. This refers to the revelation of the shchina. Kamashin emar, o hanisa elokim lavo lakachas lo goy mikarev goy b'masos b'osos b'mofasim v'milchama. As it is said, or God has ventured to go and take for himself one nation from the midst of another by prodigious acts, by signs and portents, by war, by a mighty hand and an outstretched arm and awesome power, as the Lord your God did for you in Egypt before your very eyes. And then finally, and and by signs, this is the staff, as it is said, and take with you this staff with which you shall perform the signs. And portents, this refers to the blood, as it is said, I will set portents in the sky and on earth, blood and fire and pillars of smoke. And now, that's the portion that we find ad kan. That's the portion that we find in the Babylonian version of the Haggadah. Now, before we move on to the second bit, which is the bit that's found in the Eretz Yisrael Haggadahs, I'd like you to think a bit about what might be strange about what we've read so far. In fact, actually, let's quickly read that next paragraph, because it'll give you a hint of what's strange in the first half. Davar Acher, another version of what this pasuk means, instead of meaning all of the things that we just said, what this pasuk means when it says that God took us out with a mighty hand and outstretched arm and so on and so forth, it simply means Biad Chazaka, Shtayim, V'zoro Netuya, Shtayim, V'mar Gadol, Shtayim, V'oso Shtayim, V'mofsim Shtayim, Elo Eser Makos, Shehidia Kadosh Baruch Hu Al Mitzrayim, Mitzrayim. There are five clauses in the pasuk. Each one refers to two of the Makos. Add up five units of two, and you get 10 plagues. When it says that God took us out with a mighty hand and signs and everything else, that simply refers to the Eser Makos. Okay, that's the second version. That's the version that they have in Eretz Yisrael. Now the question is, what is strange about the first half? Let's think about it. The second half tells us, the Davar Acher version tells us, that this pasuk is simply referring to the 10 plagues. Now, in the first half, are any of the plagues mentioned? Well, let's think. Well, right, so we're getting yeses and noes. Why? The reason we're getting noes is, well, I'd like to hear why we're getting some yeses. Which plagues do we find? Pestilence, Dever.
And Dam.
Sally, we have Dam. Do we have any other ones?
No.
Doesn't look like it. Now, why were some people saying no? Because are we getting all 10?
No.
Certainly not. We're certainly not getting 10. Right, so we're getting two plagues, it seems like. Dever and Dam. Right? Pestilence and blood. So question number one, why are we only treated to mention of 2 out of the 10 plagues? In other words, this pasuk is referring to God's act of taking the Jewish people out of Egypt with a mighty hand and in full view of the Egyptian people with signs and portents and so on. Now, this drasha, which is only in the diaspora versions of the Haggadah, is telling us that these signs refer, seemingly, at first glance, to only 2 out of the 10 plagues. So question number one is why? Number two, what is strange about the portion that begins Uvizroa Netuya by an outstretched arm, which is the second passage. What's strange about that? What does it say that an outstretched arm refers to?
The sword.
The sword. What is the sword? Is there a sword in the Exodus story? No. If anybody can think of one, I'd be glad to hear. So Mr. Deegan is suggesting it might be figurative. So if it was going to be figurative, and this is a suggestion that we're going to entertain in just a moment. So we'll shelve that for about 35 seconds, but think to yourselves, if it might be figurative, which plague would it, of which plague would it be a figure?
Smiting the firstborn.
Ah, perhaps smiting the firstborn. Of any other suggestions? So perhaps smiting the firstborn. So shelve that for about 35 seconds. That's a suggestion. That's the suggestion that is about to be put forth by Rav David Zvi Hoffman. Okay.
Even when it refers to the plague, it's not really describing that much of a plague.
In what sense? I think you're right. In what sense do you mean that?
So like the Dom, this is Dom. But you know, Moshe Amar, these are the wonders, and then a description of different wonders. It's not really describing Dom.
Right.
A list.
Right. In other words, it's describing different things that might be impressive. You're right. It's not speaking specifically about blood. That's another good point. In other words, we have to identify why each proof text that's being cited by the Haggadah is being used. And that's an excellent point.
And then pestilence, too. There's more than one pestilence. And there's more than one thing that affected all the animals.
Oh, excellent point, Ms. D. Now, what other plagues might have affected the animals?
Arba,
hail.
There's
one right,
dogs.
One right before Dever. What's the one right before pestilence? Plague Arov, right? The wild animals. That, if we were going to pick an animal plague, it would have been the wild animal. It would have been the animal plague.
There were a lot of things that affected the animals.
Excellent. So what I'd like to do now is read two passages from some... Yes, Svetovich.
The The sword could refer to the darkness when you had all the killing.
Ah, that's an excellent suggestion. So keep that in mind. We're going to come back to that at the very end. That's a very important point. It's that the sword might have referred to an early midrash. It appears in the Mechilta. The only reason it's actually, well, we'll get to that in the end. It appears in the Mechilta. It appears in three places in the Mechilta that says, on the pasuk of Chamushim Alu, that the Jewish people left armed, so the word Chamushim is taken homiletically to refer not to being armed, but to being one out of a, or sort of one out of a numeral involving a five. Either one in five Jews left, one in 50 Jews left, or one in 500 Jews left. Now, what would that mean that one in 500 Jews left? What happened left in the Exodus story? What happened to the rest of the Jews that didn't leave? So the Midrash in the Mechilta says, Mesu b'shloshes yimei ha'afela. They died during the 3 days over which the plague of darkness extended. Why? Because they weren't interested in being part of the Jewish people as they left Egypt, and because they didn't want to partake of the redemption of the Jewish people, they were simply removed from the Jewish people. They were excised by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's an important and rather early homiletical tradition that we're going to return to in just a moment. So keep that in our, let's keep that in our back pocket. Okay. What I'd like to do is read two bits of commentary, one rather recent and one quite early, that's going to point up, I think, two distinct problems that we encounter in this text and hopefully help us focus our discussion. Okay, now, take a look at, just make sure the recording's still going. Okay, take a look at source number two. The first is from the commentary of Rav David Tzvi Hoffman. Just a bit of background, David Tzvi Hoffman should be really a much more of a hero than he is to our community. He's a giant of a Talmud Chacham. He was sort of, he lived at the end of the 19th, early 20th century. He was the Rosh Yeshiva of the Rabbinical Seminary in Berlin. He was a Talmud of Israel Hildesheimer and also of the Maharam Shik, I believe. He was a monumental Torah scholar as well as a person with extensive academic training in the history of Judaism. And as such, he contributed a great deal and much work that's incredibly creative, not just to traditional Torah journals, but also to academic journals. One of the great accomplishments for which he must be credited is with beginning the work of restoring a Midrash of Mechilta Derebi called Mechilta Derebi Yishmael. Now, the Mechilta Derebi Yishmael, the famous Mechilta Derebi Yishmael, is a Midrash on Shemos. We don't have, there are hints here and there of a Mechilta existing on Sefer Dvarim, but it had never been found. What Rav David Tzvi Hoffman did was he postulated that in a later Midrash HaGadol, there were preserved fragments of a Midrash on Dvarim that could not be found anywhere else. Eventually that Midrash, although in different form, was identified as the Mechilta on Sefer Dvarim. So Rav David Tzvi Hoffman essentially discovered Yesh Me'ayin, a Midrash on Dvarim. So in his, what he called it was Midrash Tanayin. So this Midrash, which eventually morphed or transformed later into a fully fledged Mechilta on Dvarim, this work began with Rav David Tzvi Hoffman. Now when he put together this Midrash on Midrash Tanayin, he appended to it a commentary. And one of the comments that he makes on this Midrash and Dvarim that he's identified relates to the bit of the Haggadah that we have here. In particular, he refers to the appearance in our Haggadah of two things that we've all just identified together, whose presence in our Haggadah seems to be anomalous, and that is the Dever and the Cherev. What is Dever out of all the plagues doing here? And second of all, what in God's name is the Cherev? What is the sword that this is referring to? Now, take a look in source number two, which is from Rav David Tzvi Hoffman's commentary, and he says the following: "V'hinei dever haya hamaka hachamishis v'haisa yidei Hakadosh Baruch Hu be'atzma v'chein hamaka ha'asiris cherev ze makas bechoros v'alkein midrash dilan acharei she'amar ela Hakadosh Baruch Hu be'atzmo darash b'yad chazakov zoron etuya al dever v'cherev." And behold, pestilence, says of David Tzvi Hoffman, Dever, was the fifth plague. And the fifth plague is distinct in that it was performed by God himself. It wasn't performed by Moshe or by Aharon or by anybody else. Likewise, the tenth plague, the sword, which of David Tzvi Hoffman says, along with Mr. Deegan, refers to the plague of the firstborn, Makas Bechoros. And thus, our Midrash, just after it said, rather it was God himself, just after our Midrash says that God himself took the Jewish people out of Egypt, lo yadei malach, lo yadei shaliach, not by an angel, not by a messenger, and so on and so forth. It explicated the words with a mighty hand and with an outstretched arm as referring to Dever, to pestilence, and to Cherev, the plague of the firstborn. Why? As Rav Dov Tzvi Hoffman intimates, because those two plagues were the two plagues that were performed by God himself. So here lies a very neat explanation for why those two things appear. Dever, of all the plagues, appears because God himself performed it, and Makas Bechoros as well appears because God himself performed it. Now there are two very great problems, or at least, in fact, three very great problems with this explanation, and may force us to look elsewhere for an answer. What are some of the problems with this explanation? Right. In other words, if this is the theme of the Midrash, why have anything else other than Dever and Cherev? Right. Number one. Number two. Well, the Rav Dov Tzvi Hoffman is attempting to explain why two out of the 10 plagues appear in this section, and he gives an answer. What's the problem with that? How many plagues appear in this paragraph? Three.
The first one, you have the blood.
Right. You have the blood. Exactly, as Mr. Comment says, you have the blood. He hasn't explained how the blood appeared. The blood was performed by Moshe. Problem number two. Problem number three is as follows. Is it true that those are the only two plagues that God performed himself? Which other plague did God perform himself? I don't expect anybody to know this off the top of their heads. It's another animal plague that we mentioned. Arov. Arov was performed by God himself as well. So, according to the logic of Rav Dov Tzvi Hoffman, Arov should have appeared somewhere in this exegesis as well, and yet it appears nowhere. And then finally, in this we won't really have time to investigate this, it shouldn't detain us now, but the association of the word cherev, sword, with the plague of Makas Bechoros is seemingly very problematic. The word cherev never appears anywhere, in the context of any of the Eser Makos, of any of the 10 plagues, anywhere in Chumash's narrative, nor anywhere else in Tanakh that refers to the 10 plagues. So on what basis is Rav Dov Tzvi Hoffman associating the word cherev with the 10th plague with Makas Bechoros? This is an issue that could actually last us an entire shir. We don't have time to investigate it now. Suffice it to say, I don't think that there are any very good grounds to associate cherev with the word cherev with Makas Bechoros. Yes?
For the karban, would you not use the word cherev? You would use like the word for knife, right? Because the karban pesach, that you can associate with Makas Bechoros.
Perhaps.
You know, like a Yitzhak or whatever, that instead they sacrifice the carbon and then they put the blood on their door.
Perhaps.
So then but I don't know that you would
use the word. Right, you wouldn't use the word sword. Sword, in fact, you might be problematic in the context of a carbon, because the one way that it's prohibited to slaughter an animal is via nechira, via stabbing, right? So if you want to slaughter an animal, you need to do shchita. You need to do slaughtering with a ritual knife. You can't use a sword. So, but that's an excellent point. In other words, and it just points up, and that's in fact why I quoted Rav Dov Tzvi Hoffman, it points up the difficulty in our passage. Rav Dov Tzvi Hoffman has to resort to, in a sense, some very creative exegesis in order to explain this passage. And it should only hint to us, it should only alert us to the fact that this is a deeply puzzling piece of the Haggadah. Now, take a look, and in order to point up one more issue, which nobody has mentioned yet, take a look at the comment just below that by the Ra'avan, of Elazar ben Nasan of Mainz, who is one of the early Ashkenazic scholars. And he says, in explaining the paragraph, Uv Osos, and by signs, Zehamateh, this is the staff. Now, here's the comment that he makes, and try to figure out why he's making this comment. Sha'asa bo Moshe es ha'osos. Because with the staff, Moshe performed the signs. Now, what difficulty in the passage is he responding to? Think about it. The verse says that God took the Jewish people out of Egypt with signs and with portents. Now, we would have assumed that those signs are the 10 plagues. The Midrash here, in the Babylonian rite, says that the signs refer to the staff. Why is that difficult? Did the staff constitute a sign? No. Explains the Ra'avan, it was the thing that was used, it was the object that was used to facilitate the signs. What he's pointing to is actually a great difficulty in the Haggadah, which is that, why of all things would you associate the word os, the signs, with the one thing in the narrative that isn't a sign, the staff? We could have associated it with any of the plagues, with any of the miracles, with Kriyas Yamsuf, with the splitting of the sea, with anything. Why the staff? The staff is the one thing in the narrative that isn't a sign. It's used to facilitate the signs, but it itself is not a sign. This is the difficulty that the Ravan is pointing to, and that's why he attempts to explain why the word osos, signs, can in fact refer to the staff. But it should only point to the fact that that's in fact that that is in reality a very difficult prospect. So what I'd like to do is...
How can you just make out that a word osos means a staff? I mean...
So that, I think...
What logic does he come...
Right, so in fact, so what he's dealing with, as Mr. Comet's pointing out, is the fact that if the word mateh, and here I'll give you a hint where I'm going, if the word mateh, the word staff, does in fact refer to Moshe's staff as it's used over the course of the 10 plagues, then in fact it would be quite acrobatic to insist that it itself can be called an os, a sign. Because it wasn't a sign. It facilitated signs, but the staff wasn't a sign to anybody. No one noticed the staff. When frogs were pouring into your house, when your bed was ridden with lice, the last thing you were thinking about was the fact that Moses had a walking stick. So it's true.
Aaron took it and hit the water with it.
Dr. Schwartzbaum...
were active acts with the staff.
Right, so Dr. Schwartzman is getting closer, which is to say that Moshe's staff, Moshe's mateh, his staff was actually quite a versatile object. Later on in the narrative of Chumash, and according to some of the Midrashim of Chazal, Moshe's mateh takes on quite mythical proportions. But in fact, what I'd like to point out is that earlier in the narrative, can we think of any instance where Moshe's staff was used...
with a snake.
Ah, so hold that thought. Take a look at source number 3. Source number 3 gives us, I think, the beginning of an answer, or rather a foot in the door in terms of explaining the narrative thrust or the logical, or rather the rhetorical logic of this entire passage. Take a look at source number 3. Source number 3 is from a commentary on the Haggadah by Rav Aaron Hakohen of Lunel, a famous halachist. He has a commentary that was published in his name on the entire Siddur. And part of that commentary contains a parish, a commentary on the Haggadah. And he says the following. And he doesn't take this any further, which is quite curious. He says, Uvamofsim, referring to the very last bit there, and portents, which the Haggadah in the Babylonian rite had said, this Zehadam, this refers to the blood, seemingly the plague of blood. So he says, Parish, Lomi makas hayaor ka'amar, Ella me'asher hayu ladam ve'yabashes kasher asa ha'osos le'inei ha'am sh'al yedei oso ha'os ha'aminu bo kol Yisrael. He says, and with portents, the explanation. It refers not to the plague of the Nile, not to the plague of blood that afflicted the Egyptians, but rather to that it turned to blood upon dry ground when he performed the signs in front of the entire nation, that via the sign, or that sign, all of Israel believed in him. What is the Or Chaim saying? Or Chaim is saying that Zeh Adam, this is the blood, refers not to Makastam, not to the plague of blood, but rather to another instance of blood appearing in our narrative. And what is that? So take a look at the source right below this. Exodus 4:9, Perek Dalet in Parsha Shemos. V'haya, im lo ya'aminu gam l'shnei ha'osos ha'ele, v'lo yishma'un l'kolecha, and it shall come to pass, God says to Moshe Rabbeinu, if they will not believe even these two signs and shall not listen to your voice, that you shall take from the water of the river and pour it onto the dry land, and the water that you take out of the river shall become blood upon the dry land. So the scene. A young Moshe Rabbeinu is living with his father-in-law in Midian. He stumbles upon the snat, the burning bush, and is confronted by HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. And God says to Moshe, God charges Moshe with returning to Egypt to join with his brethren, and thereby, via his leadership, to free them from bondage in Egypt. Moshe's complaint is, who's going to believe me? I am some foreign guy. I ran away and I abandoned my family, my brethren, in Egypt so I could save my own skin. Coming back now, and I'm going to tell them what? God spoke to me, let's get out of Egypt. They're going to laugh in my face. First of all, I haven't shared in their suffering. I didn't grow up with them. Second of all, who's going to listen to some crazy telling them God spoke to me from a burning bush, no less? It seems like a reasonable complaint, question. So God says, I'll help you out. I will provide you with signs so that when you return to your people, when you return to Am Yisrael, you can present them with these signs and thereby convince them that you are in fact a messenger of God. And what is the final, most convincing sign that Moshe presents? It is that he turns water into blood, presaging the plague that he will inflict thereafter upon the Egyptians. So says the Or HaChaim, what does it mean, biyad chazaka, when the pasuk says biyad chazaka, with a mighty hand? It means that when God took the Jewish people out, when the pasuk says that God took the Jewish people out with a mighty hand, it's referring not to a plague that he inflicted upon the Egyptians. What a mighty hand means is that God, in fact, demonstrated to the Jewish people his power. What was one way that he did this? Via the sign that with which he provided Moshe, via the blood, the dam. Or Chaim leaves it at that. But armed with this insight, I think we can now reverse engineer the process by which this paragraph, this central paragraph in the Haggadah, came to be. So what I'd like to do now is work backwards. Or Chaim situated us at the end, the very last paragraph, Hamofsim, the portents, this is the blood. The blood is referring to the blood that with which the Jewish people were confronted by Moshe. Now let's work backwards. Take a look at source number 4. So if you'll need to, you can refer back to source number 1 to see where we are. The next one we're going to look at is Uva Osos, and by the signs, Zehamateh, this is the staff. Now what might that refer to? So we raised the difficulty with understanding it as referring to Moshe's staff over the course of the 10 plagues, because over the course of the 10 plagues, all the staff was used was for facilitating the plagues. However, prior to this point in the narrative, let's take a look at source number 4. Vayomer Elav Hashem, Maze Biyodecha. Moshe again asks God, he says, what am I going to tell the Jewish people? How are they going to believe me? And God says to him, what's that in your hand? Vayomer Mateh, says it's a staff. Vayomer Hashlicheyu Arza, Vayashlicheyu Arza, Vayhila Nachash, Vayanas Moshe Mipanav. Vayomer Hashem Moshe, Shalach Yadacha, Vachos Biznavo, Vayishlach Yadov, Vayachazakbo, Vayhila Mateh Bekapo, Laman Yaminu, Kinera Elecha Hashem Elokei Avosam, Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Velokei Yaakov. God said to Moshe, what is that in your hand? He said, it's a staff. The Lord said, throw it on the ground. So Moshe threw it upon the ground and it became a snake. Then he picked it up by the tail and it returned back into and it transformed again back into a regular staff. And God says to Moshe, it is via this sign as well that the Jewish people will believe you. Now, I think what we've identified here is a point in the narrative where the staff itself is used as a sign. And in fact, take a look at the next verse I've provided you there. This staff, take in your hand, and with it you will perform miracles. That is the proof text that the Haggadah used to substantiate that the word osos, signs, in fact does refer to the staff, because this is the one time, the most important time in the narrative of the Exodus where the word os, sign, is used in the context with the word mateh, with the word staff. Now, when is this referring to? It's not referring to any of the plagues. This pasuk that the Haggadah quotes is referring only to when Moshe used the staff in front of the Jewish people. So here, too, again, it's clear that the Haggadah is not referring to anything that happened during the 10 plagues. He's referring to miracles that God performed on behalf of or in front of the Jewish people. Let's go back one more step. And it's important to keep in mind. When the Haggadah is explicating this pasuk, so it's important to recall what the pasuk says. And keep this in mind as we go back. The pasuk says, God took the Jewish people out of Egypt with a mighty hand, with an outstretched arm, with great wonders, with signs and portents. traditionally, and I think simply, we understand this as a reference to the 10 plagues, to all the miracles that God performed on behalf of the Jewish people to save them from the Egyptians. What we're seeing here is that in the diaspora, in contradistinction to an Eretz Yisrael, where in fact it did refer to the 10 plagues, in the diaspora, this verse is being used as if it is referring not to anything that God did to save the Jewish people from the Egyptians. It is used, exactly, it is used to indicate things that God used to save the Jewish people from themselves. From disbelief in the possibility of redemption. Now let's go back a little bit further. Take a look at source number 5, and here's where we're going to return to the archaeological roots of this class. Take a look at source number 5. Source number 5 is referring back to that portion in the bit of the Haggadah, which says, Uvmora gadol, and with awesome power. Awesome power refers to the revelation of the Shechina. Now, most commentators on the Haggadah understand this as referring perhaps to Kriyas Yamsuf, a time when God's presence was revealed before a host of people, Jews and Gentiles, especially to the Egyptians. It could refer to that. It could refer to God's revelation in front of the entire world, Gentiles included. However, it's important to point out that in the language of Tanakh, Giloi Shechina, the revelation of God's presence, is always, or always appears, rather, in the context of revelation to the Jewish people. In fact, there's an important pasuk in the book of Samuel and Sefer Shmuel that makes this point explicitly. Take a look at source number 5. Vayavo, and now, source number 5 we have to be careful with, because source number 5 is given to interpretation. So what I'd like to do is read that pasuk, read the pasuk we're about to read, and then I'd like somebody to call me out on the leap that I'm making, okay, in terms of how I've translated it. Vayavo, usually Malvina is the one who does this. Unfortunately, she couldn't be here this evening. Vayavo ish Elohim el Eli, vayomer Elov, ko amar Hashem, haniglo niglesi el beis avicha, behiosam b'mitzrayim leveis paro. A man of God came to Eli and said to him, thus said the Lord, did I reveal myself to your father's house when they were in Egypt, in bondage to the house of Paro? Of course I did, that's what I did. I revealed myself to the Jewish people when they were in the house of Paro. Now what have I done there that's a little bit dodgy? The end of the pasuk says, did I reveal... before we get to the question, the argument I'd like to make is that here, God is saying, I revealed myself in Egypt. Now to whom did I reveal myself in Egypt? Only to Beis Avicha, to your father's house. Not to the Egyptians, to Beis Avicha. Now, if you can take a look at the original Hebrew, I've done something a little tricky. The pasuk says, Haniglo Niglesi, using that the same root used for Giloi Shechina, the revelation of the Shechina, of the divine presence, I revealed myself to your father's house when they were in Egypt, Behiyosam B'mitzrayim, Leves Paro. Now the way I've translated that is as if there was an extra word there. As if the word, as if what that means is to your father's house when they belong to Beis Paro, Leves Paro, when they belong to the house of Pharaoh. What it also could mean is that I revealed myself El Beis Avicha, Behiosam B'Mitzrayim, to your father's house when they were in Egypt, and Leves Paro, to the Egyptians. That could mean I revealed myself not just to the Jews, but also to the Gentiles. Now, there are two bits of evidence that I have that I can muster in my defense to show that, in fact, the pasuk does not mean that and has never been interpreted to mean that. And I have two examples. Number one is, take a look at the source below that on the left. It's from Targum Yonasan. Targum Yonasan, now, people are usually familiar with Targum Yonasan, with the Targum Jonathan that appears on Chumash. Targum Yonasan on Chumash is not, in fact, Targum Yonasan. There's no such thing, according to the Gemara, as a Targum Yonasan on Chumash. Targum Yonasan on Chumash really should be called Talmud Yerushalmi, probably. However, there is an authentic Targum that is attributed to someone named Yonasan ben Uziel, that appears on Navi. Now, that Targum is an extremely ancient Targum, and most recently can be dated in its earliest form to actually the late 1st century of the Common Era, maybe the early 2nd century, really shortly after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. It was eventually edited in Bavel in the 4th century. Now, what does Targum Yonasan say on this pasuk? It interprets the end of this pasuk as follows. I'll read the beginning and I'll translate the end. Vasa neviya da Hashem levas Eli, v'amar le chidnan amar Hashem, iskala iskalesi al beis avuch, kad havo b'mitzrayim, shubdin leves paro. This is how he translates the verse, exactly how I've translated it. And the prophet of God came to Eli and said to him, thus said the Lord, I was surely revealed to your father's house when they were in Egypt, when they were subject to the house of Paro. So Leves Paro doesn't mean, and also to the Egyptians, it means when your forefathers belonged to the house of Paro. There's another very fascinating piece of evidence that substantiates it, and I've given it to you there. We're going to read a manuscript together. Take a look on the right. This is one of the Dead Sea Scrolls. It was discovered in the 4th cave at Qumran, and what it is a biblical manuscript of the book of Samuel, the book of Shmuel. It is a little bit different from the text that we have of the book of Shmuel, the Masoretic text, the text established by the Baalei HaMasorah, the traditional text. Why this text is a little bit different is a complicated issue in and of itself. Maybe we'll have a class on that one day. But in any event, it adds a word into this pasuk that explains what the pasuk means. And we're going to look at what it is. Take a look. Here at the very end, we can see the words Amar, Ko Amar Hashem. So if you look back up, you can identify where that is in the Pasuk. Ko Amar Hashem. And then the next line, which is cut off, unfortunately, because the manuscript was torn. Haniglo Niglesi Abes Avicha Bihiyosam. Then at the very end here, you can see that last mem of Bihiyosam. And then what's that next word? Can anyone read that? Yes, Avadim. Avadim Leves Paro. So the Dead Sea Scrolls, in their version of the text, added in the word Avadim in between B'hiyosam b'mitzrayim Leves Paro, in order to tell you that the verse should be interpreted not, I revealed myself to the Jews and to the Egyptians, but I revealed myself to the Jews when they were slaves to the house of Paro. So what this verse is clearly indicating is that the revelation of the Shekhinah, the revelation of God's presence, only takes place in front of the Jewish people. And that doesn't mean that God does not have a relationship with all of his creatures. This certainly is the case. And in fact, the verses in Isaiah, the psukim in Yeshayahu tell us that we'll all, at the end of days, go together to the Beis Hashem, to the house of God, and sacrifice there together. But in terms of mechanically how revelation works, revelation as such, at least at this point in history, is only taking place in front of the Jews. And therefore, when the Baal Haggadah says here, Uvamora gadol, with awesome power, I made known my presence, the Baal Haggadah is interpreting that as a reference to Giloy Shechina, to the revelation of the divine presence, which only takes place in front of the Jewish people. So far, this entire bit of the Haggadah can be read as God revealing himself to the Jewish people. And then finally, and this is the kicker, take a look at source number 6. We began our investigation with a question that has really plagued the Rishonim and the Achronim for the last millennium and a half, more than that. And that is, what in the world is the word cherev doing here? The sword. What is the sword? There's no sword in the entire narrative of the Exodus. Nowhere in Sefer Shmos, in fact, does the word cherev, I believe, appear. And secondly, and less importantly, but secondly, why is there a reference to the pestilence, to the dever, of all the plagues, of all the 10 plagues, why the dever? In fact, there is one place in Shmos where the word cherev appears, and that is a bit earlier than the 10 plagues. Take a look at source number 6. Moshe and Aharon approach Paro and beseech Paro for permission, at least for permission for the Jewish people, to leave Egypt temporarily to worship HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the desert. And they tell Paro that if we don't leave, if we don't come together as a people and embrace our ethnogenesis and embrace our founding as a nation, as a people, if we don't partake in a redemptive act, then the following is going to happen, says Moshe. Ve'yomru, Elokei ha'ivrim nikra alinu, ne'elacha na derech sholshes yamim ba'midbar, v'nizbecha la'ashem Elokeinu pen yifka'enu ba'dever ovecharev. They said, the God of the Hebrews has met with us. Now let us take a 3-day journey into the wilderness to offer sacrifices to the Lord our God, or he may strike us with dever, or with the cherev, with pestilence, or with the sword. This, I believe, is what the Haggadah is referring to, this pasuk. If we, the Jewish people, do not worship HaKadosh Baruch Hu appropriately and properly, then we are threatened with pestilence and with the sword. So Dever and Cherev serve again as two signs that are designed to convince the Jewish people to worship God properly. So to sum up, if you take a look now originally at the paragraph that we've just investigated, you can see that every single bit is referring to the relationship not between God and Gentiles, but between God and Jews. Dam refers to the sign that Moshe presented to the Jewish people. The Mateh refers to the sign that Moshe used in creating the snake out of his staff. Gilei Shechina, we know from Sefer Shmuel and from the Dead Sea Scrolls and from the ancient Targum, refers to a process or to a mechanism that takes place only in front of the Jewish people. The revelation of God's presence is only in front of Jews, at least in this narrative. And finally, the sword, the cherev, and dever, the pestilence, are two things with which the Jewish people were convinced to worship God appropriately. Now, where does this leave us? Both in terms of the history of the Haggadah and to our contemporary practice as Jewish people and as a community. In the Babylonian version of the Haggadah, our Haggadah, the Haggadah of the Jewish people living in the diaspora, we have two versions of how this pasuk should be read. One of them we share in common with our brethren in Eretz Yisrael. The one that we all share in common seems to be the simple way of reading the verse. God took us out with a mighty arm, with a mighty hand, an outstretched arm, with signs, with portents. This refers to the 10 plagues. When God took the Jewish people out of Egypt, this was the grandest representation of his protection of the Jewish people, and moreover, his signal to the nations of the world that this tiny, insignificant people should be accorded the respect that it deserves as ambassadors of God and as those charged with providing guidance to the rest of the world in what it means to be servants of the divine. In Eretz Yisrael, in the land of Israel, it's crucial that this be recalled. The land of Israel is constantly under attack by its neighbors, by hostile neighbors. This has been true not just for the last 70 years, but for all of history. The Holy Land, as the Crusaders knew it, the land of Israel, the land of the people of the book, as the Muslims knew it, Yavuz, the city of Yerushalayim, the ancient city of Yavuz, as the Sheva Amamin, the seven nations of Canaan, knew it all the way back in the biblical period, Eretz Yisrael was constantly desired by all those who could possess it. And so on Pesach, the holiday of redemption, the holiday that commemorates our coming together as a nation, and our acceptance of our, at times, onerous but always wonderful responsibility to be emissaries of God, it's precisely then that we have to recall that we can never give up, that God is always looking after us, that God is always protecting us. And how do we remember this? By the signs and the portents, by the 10 plagues. God will always be there to protect our nation from external threats. And in Eretz Yisrael, in the land of Israel, it was always crucial that the Jewish people recall this. And so too in the diaspora. Diaspora Jews have often been persecuted, have often been targeted simply because of their identity, and as such, we need to recall that God is protecting us so that we can do the best that we can to be Mekadshei Shem Shamayim in this world, to sanctify God's name among the nations. Ad kan, the commonality between the land of Israel and the diaspora. The diaspora, however, has an additional challenge. And this, I think, is most pertinent to us as a community. Whereas in the land of Israel, the very air that you breathe is saturated with kedusha, with holiness. There's no need, almost, there's no need to recall that we must partake in redemption. When you look at Har HaBayis, you look at the Temple Mount. When you go north, and you see the very towns where the Tanaim lived, the Amorayim lived, the sages of our history lived. When you see the Yam HaGadol, when you see the Kinneret, when you see the Negev, all of these places that feature so prominently in our history, there's no need to recall that we as a people must always retain our identity. There's no need. Here we have a need. In the diaspora, as wonderful as it can be, and as many opportunities as we have, that in some cases are not available to the Jews of Eretz Yisrael, to be Mekadei Shem Shamayim, to spread to the entire world, to convey to the entire world what it means to be a servant of God. We have contacts that the Jews in Eretz Yisrael perhaps don't have. They're insulated from society in a way that we are not. So we have opportunities. But, at the same time, we are assailed constantly by the inertia of a culture, or of cultures, in our case Western culture, that, not maliciously, but simply by virtue of inertia, would obliterate our own if we let it.
Assimilation.
Assimilation. We're threatened with assimilation, with severe acculturation at all times. Now, we can take advantage of this by being Mekadei Shem Shamayim, by sanctifying the mundane in our lives. And this is our charge as modern Orthodox Jews, really as Jews anywhere, but we have chosen to bear this standard. But at the same time, we need Pesach. We need the holiday that commemorates our national genesis to remind ourselves constantly that we must retain our identity. As we sit here, thank God, comfortably on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, where we are fortunate to be living, not just on the Upper West Side, in America. We are the most fortunate Jews in history. We're not persecuted, by and large. We have opportunities to serve in government. We have opportunities to participate in culture, to contribute to culture, to advance the sciences, to advance literature, to learn in numbers that were unimaginable to our ancestor, to do serious learning. But we have to recall that none of this is automatic. We have to fight for this. We have to fight to keep this a reality. And the holiday that serves as our clarion call to battle in this regard is Pesach. And that is why, in the Haggadahs of Bavel, in the Babylonian rite of the Haggadah, we have an extra midrash. We have a davar acher. We interpret the verse that refers to God's revelation, God's interference in history, as referring not to his obvious signs, explicit signs in front of the entire world, but to the private relationship that he cultivated with his people. To the dam, to the snake, to the revelation of the Shechina, to the Dever, to the pestilence, and to the Cherev, to the sword. And that is the lesson, I believe, of the Babylonian rite of the Haggadah. With that, we will conclude. If there are any questions, I'd be absolutely delighted to take them. Just allow me to stop this recording.